So we have a lot of folks with us for the first time tonight, for a while at least. So to let you know what we're doing, we are in Ephesians chapter 4 tonight. And what we're doing is we are having laid the foundation that Paul does in the first three chapters about what it is to be people who are saved by grace and through faith. What we've been doing then is talking about what this means for us in our relationship with each other. How do we put the gospel into practice in this relationship? And so we're going to be building off of the passage that starts in Ephesians 4. And on Sunday, we introduced verse 25. Therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. And on Sunday, then, we just talked about the idea of speaking the truth in love as a key component of our relationship. And Dean, as we talked about that, what is the balancing act that we have talked about in speaking the truth in love?
We kind of mentioned the idea of truth within itself is just actual, kind of like the letter of the law. You could speak truth without having any kind of graciousness or without any kind of tact to it. So we kind of just contrasted those two things, that in love gives this idea that we should be delivering that truth in a way that has a purpose, and that purpose is love. So I guess that would be a summary.
That's it. And if you could imagine that above me, that we just had one slide up, and on one far side of it, it says speaking the truth, and on the other far side of it, it says speaking in love. And for those of you who were here Sunday, we did sort of a self-survey to figure out, would you say that generally speaking, you're more liable to speak truth without love, or you're more likely to speak in love but maybe hedge the truth? And it was very interesting to first of all, to see how many of us have a real self-awareness of where our place on that spectrum may lie. And so tonight, what I hope we can do is build on that and talk in practical terms of how do we nudge that needle to the middle so that we are speaking the truth in love. And it's not one or the other, but it's both and. Now, I was really worried because Sunday, just at the very end of class, I just kind of tossed out a suggestion to take some time maybe and look for a few proverbs that have to do with how we talk to each other, because there are a lot of proverbs that deal with this. And I was afraid, because I mentioned it really like at the very tail end of class, that maybe it wouldn't have kind of stuck as an idea, but at least one person I know actually thought about it, because as soon as I was walking in tonight, Wade Mullins accosted me with a couple of proverbs that he had looked up. And they are the proverbs that quite often people print out and put on their dormitory wall, like don't stay in your neighbor's house too long lest he get sick of you, or don't be obnoxious and wake your friend up too early in the morning, those kinds of things, all right? But I am curious, did anybody else have, or just any spring to your mind now, any proverbs that would kind of go along with what we were talking about speaking the truth in love? Anybody? Oh, yes, Katie. Yes. Yeah, so let's take a look at that. Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 17. And I have that one on, I have verse 18 on my list because it ties into our theme this year. So gold star student of the class so far. And you know, I was wondering, was there any particular impulse to want to really look these up, like because of a roommate situation or anything like that, that you wanted to? No. Okay, good. Very good. So verse 17 says, whoever speaks the truth gives honest evidence, but a false witness utters deceit. Verse 18, there is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts. You know that old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me? It's like one of the biggest lies, most fraudulent statements that have ever been made. It's truly idiotic. Some of the worst damage any of us have ever faced are terrible things people have said to us. But the tongue of the wise brings theme alert, theme alert. That's right. It's our theme this year, the tongue of the wise. On the other hand, some of you have had horribly traumatic events take place in your life, and it's what someone has said to you that has made a dramatic difference in your life. So yeah, that's a great one. Verse 19, truthful lips endure forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. All right, that's great. Anybody else have some proverbs about speech on your mind? Yes, Cynthia. All right, let's take a look at those. Very good. Look at the back row coming through tonight. You know, usually the worst students are in the back row, right? We all know that from school, but these guys are coming through back there. Chapter 15. And actually, we're going to hold on to this first verse, Cynthia, because that's going to be our transition to our next topic we're going to talk about. But I promise that we will come back to that. And then, I'm sorry, what was the other verse? All right, yes, verse 28. The heart of the righteous ponders how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours out evil things. So if you think about truth, love, part of the equation is what to say. That's the truth. But what's the other part of the equation that this proverb gets at? Not just what to say, but how to say it. That's right. And I'm not even so much talking about like the tone or inflection, although that's important. That's what verse 1 is about. But it just has to do with, I mean, we've all been in these situations where you're going to have a difficult conversation with someone. And you have to stop and ask and go through in your mind, okay, how is the best way? What is the best path for me to get to this point that I can truly help that person? These are great, guys. Very good. Anybody else have one that you'd like to share? Yes. All right. Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 3. Oh, I love this one. Whoever guards his mouth preserves his life. He who opens wide his lips comes to ruin. As somebody who has a big mouth, that's always a chastening proverb to read, for sure. All right, very good. These are great. Thank you all so much for taking time to look up some of these. Yeah, Mickey?
12, 6.
Okay. 5 and 6, okay. Proverbs 12, 5 and 6. You know, I was actually thinking this afternoon when I was looking some up, we've not studied Proverbs here since I've been here. And I was looking back, I think Marty may have taught it, but it had been a long time ago. So in the wisdom books of the Bible, we have studied Job together in the adult class, and we've studied Psalms, that's poetry, but in terms of like Ecclesiastes or Song of Solomon or Proverbs, we haven't really studied those. So that might be something for us to consider in the future. Anyway, I digress. Verse 5, the thoughts of the righteous are just, the counsels of the wicked are deceitful. The words of the wicked lie in wait for blood, but the mouth of the upright delivers them. And that's another great one, Mickey, that just shows the impact, the devastating impact or the positive impact that words can have. Wade, I know you looked some up. Did you have any others you wanted to share with me other than the ones? Okay, very good. Now, when Dean and I were talking about class earlier today, he brought up a great point, which is there is another section of the Bible that contains a lot of instruction that sounds, in some places at least, like Proverbs, and that book is?
James.
The book of James. That's right. So did you have any statements from James you wanted to bring up to us tonight about?
James, are we done with Proverbs?
We are. Let's move on. We'll shift gears here a little bit.
I have a whole sermon here.
Did you? That's great. Preach it.
Okay, never
sometime.
Mind. Forget it.
No, yeah, that's all right.
See, let's go to James. James chapter 3, and we won't necessarily you know, read the whole thing. But we're all very, most of us are pretty familiar with James chapter 3. And it starts off with a warning to teachers, those that are delivering information. But that could really include, you know, you could go on a deep dive on that. But that really can include all of us whenever we're having any kind of instructional teaching or talking with each other. We're edifying and talking with one another. But in doing so, in a very interesting way, James really does lay out the idea that first and foremost, when talking about the tongue, it's good to start with the whole idea of understanding that this is something very difficult for us to manage. I mean, we can read these verses, we can read these proverbs, and we can kind of chuckle and we can kind of laugh. But the thing is if we really think about the tongue and the challenge that's before us, we would all have to start at least at the place that we all struggle with the tongue. Would everybody agree? Is there anyone here that does not struggle with the tongue and how they speak? I'm just curious. So therefore, we can all nod our heads right now, right, and say, yes, at times. Now, different varying degrees, I understand that. But the thing is what James is pointing out here is, there in the beginning, talking about the judges, and as he continues on, he is a perfect man. In verse 2 there, and if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle his own body. But if we put bits in the mouth of horses so that they obey us, we guide their whole bodies with something very little, as a bit I'm interpreting here, as well. Look at the ships also, that they are so large, but driven by such strong wind, but they're guided by something very small. I guess I was talking to one of my kids. That's why I'm talking this way. I apologize. I was just talking about these verses. I won't tell you which kid. But the deal is, so if
can
I
can we guess?
No.
Okay. All right.
So if I accidentally give some little small roundabout details, it's the dad in me kind of explaining to a child. So I apologize for that. Let me keep on going. So driven by such small winds, guided by such small rudders, wherever the will of the pilot directs it, so also the tongue is a small member, yet boasts great things. And a forest is set ablaze by small fire. The tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among many members, staining the whole body, and set on fire by hell. Very strong language there. For every kind of beast and bird and reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no human can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of full of deadly poison, which we bless our Lord and Father with, and we curse people with, who made us in the likeness of God. From the same mouth comes blessings and cursings. My brother, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring pour forth the same opening as both fresh water and salt water? Can a fig tree, my brothers, bear olives, or grapefruit produce figs? Neither can salt pond yield fresh fruits. So if we're blessing our Lord and we're building each other up, very difficult is it for us to do both. We have to do, and the tongue does do one or the other. So anyway, sorry for reading all of it, but basically
no,
it's a really good, like I said, it's good to always start from the standpoint of, hey, this is a challenge with all of us. Some of us, it might be more than others, but the bottom line is it's all of us. And so when we read these and we talk about the tongue, I actually found it fascinating, even though I'm not going to go over my whole Proverbs sermon.
We could go back to it.
No, it's okay. No, it's okay.
Maybe I spoke too rashly.
But I actually got a lot out of reading the negative effects of speech from the Proverbs. Not only the positive, you know, like the Proverbs 12, verse 5. We turned to Proverbs 12, but if you looked at verse 5, it talks about the gentle tongue. But if you look at all the negative Proverbs, I think that helps put it perspective on exactly where we need to be, because sometimes it might be difficult just to look at the positive, but look at the negatives. And if we could just stay away from the negatives, I think the positives will come and ring true. Mm-hmm. But the key, though, that if James is, this is something that we have to work towards. This is something that we have to ponder. So
I think the thing that really sticks out to me from that passage is the great damage something so small can do. And like, you know, I lived up in the Chicagoland area for 10 years, and I know we have a lot of people here who have connections up there. So my Chicagoland people, let me see how good your Chicagoland trivia is. You know, Chicago is a relatively new city because they had a great fire that destroyed much of it. And do any of you remember what the story is about how the Great Chicago Fire started? Yes, that's right. Miss O'Leary's cow knocked over a lamp. That's the story. And I don't know how much truth there is to that story or not. But here's the thing. All of us here can tell stories of horrible destruction one sentence has caused in a relationship with someone. I know that if I made a pie chart of all instances in which I've had to apologize to someone, 95% of that pie chart would be because of stupid things I said. And then the other 5% would be scattered. But that's what this passage is warning us about, mm-hmm. that one statement can cause tremendous harm.
You know, as was said, we have 2 ears and we have 1 tongue.
Yeah.
That's another thing is sometimes it's good just to listen, you know, and understand before you even speak. And that's what Proverbs 21:23 says, is the silence of the tongue.
Notice, he's just slipping it right in there.
I'm just throwing
him
in there.
See
I'm
this?
I'm ready for this, just in case those were interested. But the silence, don't avoid that, because the deal is there's a time to speak, yeah. and there's a time not to. And then a high school teacher of mine told me that the tongue is in a wet place. Don't let it slip. So I had to just throw that in there, too. So anyway, you can go on.
Very good. Now, I'm really curious if there's any instances in your all's mind of great examples you can think of in the Bible of someone who is able to communicate with someone else, maybe very in a very difficult circumstance, that you would call to mind as a premier example of the balance of speaking the truth in love. Is there anything that comes to your mind? Yeah, Justin. Okay, sure. Yeah, James 3 is good, because this is tough, and yet you can see also the manner in which he's trying to convey this is you've got to think about you're made in God's image, the other person is, and that should govern you. Very good. Any other examples you all can think of that you would say that is a great model of how to do this? Yeah, John? Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. When Nathan comes to David in 2 Samuel 12, and you know, the thing that Nathan does there is he finds a point of common ground mm-hmm. in which David is absolutely in agreement when he tells him the story about the man and the poor man with one ewe lamb and the wealthy man and so forth. And then once he finds that common ground, then when he makes the application, there's no argument from David. He just simply says, "You're right, I've sinned against the Lord." Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, Mickey?
When you first started, the lesson was truth and love.
Uh-huh.
The first thing I thought of was faith and works.
Mm-hmm.
In James.
Mm-hmm.
Because faith is useless without works. And the truth, if you don't follow up, with love is useless as well. And we just had a little conversation I did with Irma about sympathetic, being sympathy. And everybody talks how sympathetic they are with people, but what do they do to help the people that need?
Right, right.
So all three of those things, you know, remind me of the same thing. You got to have a counterbalance to what? I mean, faith, you got to do something.
Right. You know, Mickey's making what I think is a really profound point, that just like faith and works properly understood for a Christian are not an either or, but they're very much a both and, that truth and love are the same thing. Now, for the purposes of illustrating this and to help us to see the need for both, I ask you to envision a slide in which truth is on one side and love is on the other. But the reality is this: if you see someone who is in need of the truth, but you think love means not really giving them the truth, then not only are you not truthful, guess what else you're not? You're not loving either. It, you know, if I see someone who is, I got a call yesterday from a good friend of mine who's struggled with alcoholism for a long time. And it was funny, you know, thinking about how I was going to communicate with him in the course of this class, But if I don't tell him what at least I believe he needs to hear to get better because I'm afraid of hurting his feelings, then I don't love him, you know. And that's why, Proverbs 27:6 says, faithful are the wounds of a friend. Deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. And on the other hand, if I think that I can be truthful and at the same time completely run roughshod over one, I'm not being true to what the word says. So you can't be loving without being truthful if you really are loving, and you can't really be loving, really be truthful without being loving if you know what the truth is. So they actually have to go together. That's really the point. And Mickey, your comment is a really good way to bring that out. I'll tell you an example that I thought of. Kim, did you have your hand up?
That's okay.
No, go ahead. True, helpful, inspiring, necessary, kind. I'm usually firmly in the anti-acrostic camp, but you know what? I could go for that one. I like that. That's pretty good. Yeah, Pat? Pat already said it was a bad image, okay? You don't have to just pile on here to like make me feel really, really bad. No, that's exactly right. It's truth wrapped in love. Yeah. I like that. That's a great way to put that. Yeah, Justin? Now, just as Justin's asking an interesting question, are we to speak with one another differently than we would speak to someone who is in the world? Well, I would say no, in the sense that we should speak with truth wrapped in love in both instances, just understanding that our relationship as brothers and sisters is a deeper level just of, you know, intimate relationship than with those in the world. But certainly I think the same would apply. Right.
Even God himself mocks people a lot.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, is it every time it's appropriate to actually mock people?
Yeah, Justin's asking, a great question and a follow-up about, you look at the tone of someone like Elijah and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. And at the same time, we all understand, Sunday when I was preaching about Carl's example, and I talked about the passage in Colossians 4 about walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech be seasoned, as it were, with salt, so you may know how to answer each one. And so I think that there is a difference in how I may communicate if I was in a public debate with an unbeliever who was hostile versus if I'm sitting across the table with a seeker that I'm going to talk to. And yeah, I think that there's judgments that we have to make there. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great comment that you can see just a difference in tone in Matthew 23 when he pronounces woe upon the Pharisees versus, like, let's say, for example, the woman at the well in Samaria. Now, in both instances, truthful, and I would even argue in both instances, loving, giving each audience exactly what they needed and the way they needed it to try to break through and get to them. So that's a great comment. Yeah. Yeah, in all those cases, that's a great comment, Justin. Thinking had to come first. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, another example I was thinking about and it kind of goes along with how to, you know, have the right mix of truth and love. What would you say is the most severe letter the Apostle Paul writes? It would have to be between Galatians and 1 Corinthians, you would just think. Right? And I would maybe stack up Galatians, because at least at 1 Corinthians, he starts with a prayer. There's no pleasantries. It's like, he says, "Hi, Paul, apostle by the will of Christ, to the Galatians, I can't believe you people." That's sort of how it starts, right? Look at a few verses with me, though, okay? So let's look in Galatians chapter 1. So, I mean, there is just no question about the tone of what Paul says here. In verse 6, "I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are returning to a different gospel." It's not just that they're leaving the gospel. It's not that they're leaving Christ. They're leaving God. He is the one that called them in Christ. You're deserting him. I mean, there's no more stark challenge you could lay down than this. The other thing, though, I was reading through this today that I think is helpful. What does Paul say in verse 8 and verse 9 about the importance of preaching the gospel? What I'm saying to you applies not only to you, it applies to me. It applies to the angels. It's almost as if it's nothing personal. It's not like Paul woke up in a bad mood about the Galatians. It's the truth is what matters here. And it's the same truth that he has to preach and believe. Even the angels would have to follow it. So I think that's one thing about the way Paul is communicating to them, is he's showing them what's at stake here is the gospel, and everybody's accountable to it. Just like I am, just like the angels are, just like you are. Also, notice in verse 10, this gives us some more insight. Why is Paul willing to speak the truth to them? Why would he not hedge it? Maybe out of some misplaced view of love. What does he say in verse 10? "My loyalty is to God. I have to say this to you." If my loyalty was directed towards someone else, it might be different. But this is what my loyalty to God is causing me to do. I think that's another thing that's helpful, especially when you have to say hard things to people, is you want them to know, look, this is not about, I mean, I've had really gut-wrenching conversations across the table from people, and I've had to tell them, I wish I could say to you something different. But if I'm going to be true to God, I have to say what I think is true. And this is what my love for God compels me to say. Another thing, I was kind of reading through Galatians and just trying to make note of how he communicates. Go over to chapter 4. Galatians 4. And this is after he says, you know, these people have come. The Galatians, you may remember, you wouldn't remember. I mean, I don't hardly remember. We studied Galatians when I first moved here. The Galatians are Gentiles. But people have come in trying to tell them, in order to be a faithful Christian, you've also got to follow the law of Moses. Sometimes we call these the Judaizing teachers. And after Paul lists some of the things these people are trying to impose, he says in verse 11, I'm afraid I may have labored over you in vain. Brothers, I entreat you. So you see, that tone is a little different from chapter 1. It's a more, there's a well-rounded appeal here by Paul. And then he says, For I've become as you are, you did me no wrong. You know that it was because of a bodily ailment that I preached the gospel to you at first. And though my condition was a trial to you, you did not scorn or despise me, but received me as an angel, that is to say, a messenger of God, as Christ Jesus. What then has become of your blessedness? For I testify to you that if possible, you would have gouged out your eyes and given them to me. A lot of people have surmised that the physical ailment he's talking about here is some disorder with his eyes. Now, what's interesting to me in terms of what we're talking about tonight here is, what is Paul doing as he brings up this episode from the past?
He's complimenting them.
He's complimenting them. That's right. And what's he, yes, go ahead. Yeah, I like these food analogies. That's right. Compliment sandwich, compliment Oreo cookie. I like them all, yeah, but that's right. And what's the idea behind that? Right. And, you know, in the case of Paul, this we all realize this. This is not a technique. We know how much he deeply loved and cared for the people he taught the gospel. And what he's reminding them of is, you know, I'm kind of putting together in my mind a scenario where he didn't really even intend to go here, but because of whatever was going on with his eyesight, he ends up stuck there. And instead of resenting him, he says, you would have been willing to do what for me? Yeah, you would have given me your own eye. So he's reminding them of this incredible bond of love that they share with each other. And so then, notice the question he asks them in verse 16. Have I become your enemy because what? I tell you the truth. The fact that I'm having to talk to you now about a serious problem doesn't erase our history. I'm the one that you loved and I loved you. But now I have to talk to you about something because the gospel is at stake, which means your soul is at stake. And that's why he talks to them. And then also he says down in verse 19, he calls them, what does he call them? His little children. And then he says, for whom I am again in what? The anguish of childbirth. Think, like getting pagans to become Christians was a tough deal. And he says, now it's like we're having to start all over again. And then he also says, I wish I could be present with you now and change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. So even though I would argue between 1 Corinthians and Galatians, I would say Galatians even, that it starts off with like a double-barreled shotgun blast to the face, you know. I can't believe you people have departed from the gospel so soon and from God. But as it goes on, there are layers to this relationship. And, you know, this is a serious situation. And truth and souls are at stake, and yet you can also see this, the affection and love that Paul has for the Galatians. Well, there's more we could say about this. It's really interesting, really, to read the whole book and to see the points, like here in chapter 4 and also at the end of chapter 6, where Paul talks about motives. Why is he willing to say what other people are not? And the reason is they're afraid of persecution, and so they're willing to hedge the truth. He's willing to suffer and bear the marks of Christ in his body, if that's what it takes to help the Galatians. So, but yeah, a lot of great Bible examples. Jesus, of course, paramount in this. Paul in his letters, I think, really gives us some guidance in how do you approach communication that has the right blend of courage and consideration with other people. Well, Dean, anything you want to add to kind of round out this first main issue of practical application of speaking the truth in love?
I just thought of another example just off the top of my head. When you talk about Christ and, you know, Nathan, but how did God treat Cain?
Yes.
In the garden?
Yeah.
When Cain had envy in his heart, God talked him through it and comforted. I guess we could go there, but you all know he actually comforted him and encouraged him. Of course, Cain did not take the encouragement, but even God, as our example, didn't just come right down. He talked him through it. And I think that, to me, is the key summary of a lot of this. When we approach things in love and gentleness and care and healing, what we're doing is we're really pulling people alongside of us and getting us to walk in truth together. I think a lot of the times, some of these examples, it's getting people to see the truth for themselves, not that you're hammering the truth in their head or that you're even presenting it to them without having a conversation. And to me, I think that's just one of the most loving examples of delivering truth, is you get people to come to that realization themselves, because ultimately that's what matters, is that their heart is filled with that truth. And so just that in summary, and then all of a sudden, also keep in mind that what is love and what is truth? These are both, if I go into some grammar, predicate nominatives, predicate nouns, where they actually describe who God is. God is love, God is good, God is truth. Thy word is truth. That's John 17. Mm-hmm. In other words, these are attributes of God, and they're not separate. They're this incredible oneness, and we are to have the same and strive for it, just like what he said earlier to these Ephesians. So
yeah, no, that's a great point. These things are perfectly united in God, and that's what our model is as well. Now, I want to say one last thing on this point. Let's head back over to Ephesians 4. Somehow or another, I got thinking about this in the car the other day, and the waves of self-incrimination that came washing over me as I thought about this. So to make me feel better, I'm going to try to make you feel worse tonight here, okay? So of course, we're working our way now through Ephesians. I did say Ephesians, right? Mm-hmm. Ephesians 4. And we're about to move on to verse 26. Here's the other thing I want to mention. And you could say this about any of these things that Paul's going to bring up. How you talk, your temper, work ethic, forgiving. You could make this point. There is a tendency for us to say, well, you know, that's just how I am. That's just how I am. Well, here's the problem. God knows how we are, and he's not happy with it. That's why he's trying to transform us. So remember how this whole thing got started back in chapter 4, verse 17. This I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their mind, and so forth. And then he says in verse 20, but that is not the way you learn Christ, assuming that you've heard about him and were taught in him as the truth is in Jesus, to put off your old self. And verse 24, to put on the new self. The issue is not, well, that's just how I am. That holds no water here. The issue is, whatever you are, what does Christ want you to be? And to get there, there are things you've got to put off, and there's things you've got to actively put on. Mm-hmm. So some of you may be like me and are addicted to people-pleasing, and what you need to put off is this, you know, craven desire to be liked all the time, and to put on a sense of conviction about saying what has to be said because you really love people and this is what will help them, no matter what it may mean for you. And for others of us here, it may mean, you know, adopting a more forgiving spirit or a less angry spirit. But my point is, it just hit me the other night, the excuse that just can't hold any water is, oh, it's just how I am. So, sure, I know how you are. Change it. That's what the Lord is saying. It's hard and it's tough, but that's what he's calling all of us to do in a different way. So everybody feel bad about yourself Now everybody really, that's my goal here tonight, for sure. All right, so, well, Dean, let's see if we can at least introduce in 3 minutes or so our next topic that's found here in Ephesians 4, verse 26.
Be angry.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm supposed to keep reading. So we don't stop there, right?
That's okay. Right.
Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and give no opportunity to the devil.
Okay. We're going to spend most of time, obviously, on Sunday, Lord willing, talking about this. I think we have just enough time to show you a background passage to this scripture. Paul's actually quoting part of a psalm in this passage. So go back with me to Psalm 4. Psalm 4. Dean, I'm really glad you read it that way, because that's how I like to read it. I like to read it like, be angry and sin not. So see, it's okay to be angry. Just got to make sure you don't sin, but hey, it's okay to be angry. Well, it's more complicated than that. And this is the passage that I think can help us to see that. So in Psalm 4, David starts off in verse 1, answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You've given me relief when I was in distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. O men, here's his distress. How long shall my honor be turned into shame? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies? But I know the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. David has enemies who are angry with him and lying about him. So it's his enemies. And then notice verse 4, who is he saying this to? He's obviously not saying it to God. Who's he saying it to? Those enemies. Be angry and do not sin. Ponder in your own hearts on your beds and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and put your trust in the Lord. In the original context of this statement, be angry and do not sin is not a, hey, it's great, you can be angry and it's okay. It's a warning to wicked people. Be careful when you're angry, because it quickly can lead to sin, and you need to think seriously about why you're angry. So this psalm, in my mind anyway, puts an entirely different flavor to what Paul is saying. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't appropriate times to be angry. It doesn't mean that it's impossible to be angry and righteous rather than sinful. Of course that's possible. But on a practical point of view, again, if I made a pie chart of Shane's anger, 95% of it is the kind that I'm being warned about. It's not righteous indignation, okay? So just have that in mind as we prepare on Sunday to continue. And if you want to follow the same experiment, if you want to look up some Proverbs, there's a lot of Proverbs about anger. Like Proverbs 15 and verse 1, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up strife. So be thinking about that, and we can add that to the mix.